Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and it's September 21st. I got to keep this microphone up really high, but it looks like it just turned off. I got it too close to my neck, I think. Hold on. Might have to readjust it somehow or another. Maybe that'll work. Maybe. Hopefully. Now it's not on at all, right? Now that's coming back. All right, well let's try this. What color is the light? Green? This should work. All right, so today's the last lecture. Microphone's really got to work because my voice is not working today. Let me see what possibly could be wrong here. Let's try that, maybe. All right, so this is the last lecture on bones, and it's on articulations in particular. So let's see where we have this material at. This might be the most confusing of the chapters about bones. So I just want to give you a heads up on that. And so let's look at some of these things. If we need to run a little bit long going to next time, that is probably okay. All right, so, but before we start talking about all this stuff, do we have any questions over bones so far? Any questions on bones? All right, maybe I'll think of a couple questions. Where do you have, what bone has the radial notch on it? The ulna. Okay, that should be pretty easy to see if you've studied it and understand nomenclature. What bone has a zygomatic process on it? Yeah, the temporal bone. So, you know, notches and processes are not named after necessarily the bone that they exist on, but what bones that they articulate with to form those particular things, like the zygomatic arch on the temporal bone articulates with the zygomatic bone. The radial notch on the ulna articulates with the radius. That's why it's called the radial notch, but even though it's on the ulna. Yeah, the question way in the back. You're really going to have to yell.
I'm having trouble finding the inferior costal demifacet.
The inferior costal demifacet. All right, let me see if I can pull up a picture. I'm going to have to put this away, and I want to get over here anyway to look at some pictures. All right, so what skeleton are we going to be trying to look at? If all the bones in your body can be grouped into two main groups, what are the two main groups? Axial and appendicular. So I'm interested in trying to find that probably in the axial skeleton someplace, right? And I believe that is chapter 6. Let's see if that's chapter 6. That's chapter 7. All right, so give me a hint. What bone is that demifacet on? Do you know what bone? Is it in your lab list?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's look for a thoracic vertebrae. We might find it on this one that I have right here, but maybe not. Okay, did it come up? All right. Came up in the right spot. All right, so here we see a sternum and a vertebrae, and spanning this space right here is a rib, and it forms a thoracic cavity deep to the rib. So here we see the shaft. But what we're going to be looking at is the articulation between the head of a rib and the vertebral bodies. The tubercle of a rib is going to articulate with a transverse process, and it's just a one-to-one connection right there. But the head of a rib is a little bit different. The head of most ribs articulate on two vertebral bodies. One on the superior, and then here is the inferior vertebral body right here. So this is not a complete facet. This is what we call a demifacet, because it's just half of a facet. Where's the other half at? In the inferior margin in the vertebral vertebrae of the vertebrae above it. Right, so here, this is the superior costal facet, and then this would be the inferior costal facet right here. Okay? So, don't forget, maybe the best way of talking about these is not really being a facet, but a demifacet, because the head of a rib fits right between two vertebrae right here, vertebral bodies. All right, so that's where you would find it. And these things, usually, you can palpate with your fingertip pretty nicely with the vertebrae that we have in lab. Sometimes it's not really obvious with your eye, but with your fingertip, you can feel it. Once you palpate it with your fingertip, you go, oh, there it is right there. So it depends on the light a little bit sometimes. Okay, any other questions? Yeah?
How would you like us to label that on the test?
On the practicum?
Yes.
Okay, you could say costal facet. And if you want to say costal demifacet, that works for me too. Okay. It's probably not so critical in here that you know that the head of this rib is right between these vertebral bodies, but it's, you know, it's okay if you do. All right, so now we're going to move on to articulations. What's another name for an articulation? It's just a joint. That's just a fancy word for joint. And that's going to be chapter 9, I believe. Is it 10? No, it's 9. Okay. All right, so this I'm going to move over here. All right, so we want to classify joints. And there's two important ways that we classify joints. Sometimes they work together. Sometimes we just want to keep them separated. Sometimes we want to classify a joint by their structure. What makes the joint up? Other times we want to classify a joint by what its function is. And sometimes there's a nice correlation between structure and function that we'll explore in here, but usually these classification schemes are independent of each other. All right, so for instance, structural classification based on material that binds the bones together. Fibrous joints, that's a really strong kind of joint. It has dense regular connective tissue connecting the joints together. Cartilaginous is a little bit more movable joint, okay? Not quite as strong. I don't really have the volume up really high. What do I need to do? Let's try that. Okay, and then another joint is what we call synovial. And a synovial's got a bunch of different pieces that we're going to look at. That's the most complicated kind of joint because it's got a lot of pieces. All right, then we can classify joints by what kind of motion is allowed. Immovable joints are what we call synarthroses. These don't move at all. A pretty good example of that would be a suture, like we have in the skull. And a joint that is slightly movable, we're going to call that an amphiarthrosis. For instance, the intervertebral discs that allow for a little flexion and extension and a little bit of rotation, like you can twist your back a little bit. And then a diarthrosis is a freely movable joint. These are the ones you're most familiar with, like in your digits, for instance, or your elbow. So how are you going to remember synarthrosis as immovable on one end of the scale and diarthrosis on the other end of the scale as being freely movable? Because if you take the first letter of each of these, what does it spell out? It spells out a word that you're kind of familiar with, right? Sad. So synarthrosis is immovable. Diarthrosis, on the other hand, is a freely movable kind of joint. Most fibrous joints are synarthroses, are immovable joints. All right, so let's take a look at fibrous joints, which is what kind of classification a fibrous joint is. Is it a structural or functional classification? It's a structural classification, right? So it's going to have collagen fibers between the two bones. And when we say joint, we're talking about the connection between a couple bones. All right, so fibrous joints are connected by dense, regular connective tissue. They lack a joint cavity. The connective tissue goes directly from one bone to another. A really good example of that would be a suture. So for instance, here is a suture that we see in the skull, and these joints are immovable. You never see anybody's head moving around, right, when you're talking to them. Okay. Another kind, right, a syndesmosis, connected exclusively by ligaments, right, and the amount of movement varies from freely movable, which would be a diarthrosis. Okay, for instance, the distal tibiofibular joint is immovable, and the radial ulnar interosseous membrane, that's a fibrous joint, but that is a freely movable joint because you can point your palms of your hands posteriorly or anteriorly. We call that pronation and supination, and that that joint is freely movable. All right, so here's an example of the distal talofibular joint right here, and this allows for a little bit of motion. And I don't have a picture of the interosseous membrane between the tibia and fibula, as well as the radius and ulna, is a freely movable joint, but that is still just dense regular connective tissue. The last kind of fibrous joint is what we call a gomphosis. So here is an alveolus within the mandible, perhaps, or the maxilla. It's just a socket that the root of a tooth fits in. And typically your teeth don't come falling out of your mouth because they're held very tightly in position by these periodontal ligaments right here. And so that is a synarthrosis. That's an immovable joint. Your teeth shouldn't move around inside the upper jawbone or lower jawbone. Unless you chew on something really hard by accident, that might tweak on the tooth a little bit and bend some of these ligaments, and then you have a sharp jabbing pain in your mouth for just a second or so, and hopefully it goes away after that. All right, so here's an alveolar process, and then if you look on the edge of the mandible right here, you can see the alveolar margins as well, right? So the process is the point of the bone that's sticking up, and the margin is just the edge that we see right here. All right, so here is an example of a process whose function is not muscle attachment, right? So processes can also serve as attachments for ligaments as well as tendons. So what the heck is a ligament? What kind of connection is a ligament again? It's a bone-to-bone connection, right? And a tendon is a muscle-to-bone connection, which we haven't actually gotten to yet, but we will. All right, so fibrous joints. Cartilaginous joints, again, it's a type of structural classification, and we've got two, a synchondrosis, and anytime you hear chondro, what should you be thinking of? Cartilage, right? Okay, a synchondrosis has hyaline cartilage, and for instance, the epiphyseal disc, it would be a good example of a synarthrosis kind of joint. The epiphyseal disc should not move during development, and you find those epiphyseal discs before puberty in long bones. That's how bone grows in length. I don't know if I have a picture. Let's see if I have a picture of that. The epiphyseal disc or epiphyseal plate. I don't think I do. Oh yeah, here we have it. You saw it in lab in that model of a long bone. Okay, so here's the epiphyseal plate. That's a synarthrosis by function. This doesn't move. If it does move, that probably damages this joint, and then the individual's bone won't grow to its normal length after that. Okay, a symphysis is a joint. This is an amphiarthrosis. This is a slightly movable joint. For instance, intervertebral discs and the pubic symphysis between the pubic bones. Right, anterior on the pelvis. All right, so those are all cartilaginous joints. So we have fibrous joints, a structural classification, cartilaginous joints, and then another classification, which is what we call synovial. And these are really the most interesting. all of these joints. If it is a synovial joint, then it is a diarthrosis. And what can you tell me about diarthrosis? What does diarthrosis mean? Check your notes out. It is what? Freely movable, right? That's SAD, the very last word. That's the freely movable joint. All right, so let's look at a freely movable joint or a synovial joint. So again, a joint is a connection between two bones. So here we have two bones. This could represent maybe your shoulder or maybe a joint between the phalanges and a digit, for instance. Covering the ends or the epiphyses of both bones is hyaline cartilage. And sometimes we call that articular cartilage. And that prevents the bones from actually rubbing up against each other. It provides for a really smooth, slippery surface so that these bones can slide right over each other without grinding each other away. All right, so that's one part of a synovial joint, the articular cartilage. Then there is fluid, right, that nourishes that cartilage. And that fluid is what we call synovial fluid, and it's contained within the synovial cavity. And that helps lubricate and decrease inflammation on the articular surfaces of the two bones. This synovial fluid comes from the synovial membrane, which is the deepest part of the articular capsule. So the synovial membrane secretes fluid into the joint, and that's the only fluid that's coming from the synovial membrane right here that can actually nourish the few cells that are still alive in the articular cartilage. All right, so articular cartilage does not have a blood supply on its own. It gets oxygen and nutrients just from the synovial fluid. So you can imagine it doesn't regenerate very rapidly if it gets damaged, if at all. All right, then superficial to the synovial membrane is the fibrous capsule that kind of holds it all together. So that's dense, irregular connective tissue. And if we put the synovial membrane along with the fibrous capsule together, then we get something we call the joint capsule right here. On the outside of the joint capsule, there can be ligaments and tendons that span across the joint to stabilize the joint. So here is a bone-to-bone connection. That would be a ligament. So that helps stabilize this joint and provides for proper motion. All right, so this is a pretty good exam figure because it shows all the components of a synovial membrane. I mean, a synovial joint or articulation. And this kind of joint is freely movable. Okay, so number four, there's nothing that belongs in number four over here on your class notes. Okay, some synovial joints can be a little bit more complicated. Let's look at your shoulder joint here, for instance. So here is the synovial joint, starting with the articular cartilage. Here is the synovial cavity containing synovial fluid. And then the synovial membrane is going to be just inside the fibrous capsule. All right, but I see some other things happening here. This is the proximal epiphysis. Here's the glenoid fossa or cavity that the head of the humerus fits in. Here's the acromion process of the scapula that helps stabilize the joint. And then I see like a little pillow right here. All right, here's a pillow, and you should think of this pillow as like being another little synovial cavity filled with synovial fluid. So there's a synovial membrane and a fibrous capsule. And the synovial membrane is secreting synovial fluid to the inside of this little pillow. And this just protects the acromion process from getting traumatized by the motion of the head of the humerus right here, and vice versa. All right, when the humerus is moving, the subacromial bursa, because it's right underneath the acromion process, also prevents inflammation of the head of the humerus. And this little pillow can roll back and forth when you undergo certain kinds of arm motions. So this is what we call a bursa. And we have bursas in a number of parts of our body where there are bones that move within close proximity of other bones, like the acromion process right here, as well as muscles. All right? And so that just decreases inflammation. Now, a bursa can become inflamed with improper motion or repetitive use, and inflammation of a bursa is called bursitis, right? So, and then this thing gets inflamed, it gets enlarged, and then that inhibits the motion a little bit, but anytime you move that joint, then since the bursa is inflamed, there's a lot of pain associated with bursitis as well. All right, so think of a bursa as a little pillow that's designed to absorb shock and prevent inflammation between two bones or between a bone and a ligament or a bone and some muscle that's very close to it. So you can see the rolling action of the subacromial bursa when the humerus is moving, when it's rotating within the shoulder joint. All right, here is a tendon. And a tendon is a muscle-to-bone connection. And this is a tendon from the biceps muscle, which is in your anterior arm. And the biceps has two tendons. That's why we call it the biceps. Here we see one. And we can actually see it moving right through the joint, the shoulder joint. And it attaches to the scapula right above the glenoid cavity. So here's the glenoid cavity right here. It's lined with hyaline cartilage. So this would be the supraglenoid tubercle for attachment of the tendon from the biceps. Here's going to be the infraglenoid tubercle over here for attaching to the triceps, which is going to be on the posterior arm. All right, but nonetheless, this tendon goes right over the head of the humerus, and that would cause a lot of inflammation. So there's, again, like a specialized little bursa that surrounds this tendon as it's moving through the shoulder joint. And we don't really call it a bursa, we call it a tendon sheath. So a tendon sheath and a bursa are almost the same thing. It has the same properties, right? There's a fibrous membrane, a synovial membrane, then a synovial cavity with synovial fluid, which provides lubrication for this thing. But the tendon sheath surrounds a tendon that moves through a joint in particular. So it's just a little modification of a bursa. So that's a nice shoulder joint. Some joints have additional little features associated with them. Okay, some have additional pieces of cartilage. And a good example of that will be the knee joint. So let's take a look at a knee. So here is a really good example of a knee. So here we have the articular surface on the femur, and then deep down in here we have the articular surfaces on the tibia. And we got the lateral condyle and medial condyles on the femur. And here is that extra piece of cartilage within the knee. And it's fibrocartilage, it's not hyaline cartilage. So how strong is fibrocartilage compared to hyaline cartilage? Is it stronger or weaker? It's stronger because why? It has collagen in it, right? So these knee menisci are cartilage, fibrocartilage, and you see they kind of form a letter C. They're C-shaped. The tips over here are pretty narrow, right? But back over here, the cartilage is pretty thick. But also as you go from the lateral part of the meniscus to the medial part over here, it gets thin as well. It kind of looks like a wedge. All right, so these menisci can be damaged. So what would you guess? Where would be a place you would expect there to be damage? In a place where the meniscus is really thick or a place where it's really thin, like on the tips, the extreme tips right here, or in the center location? Probably where it's very thin. This is where it's most easily damaged, right? So knee menisci typically are ripped over here and over here, maybe in the middle, right? But where the meniscus is really thin. But so you can see it's thin here and then thick. So it kind of acts as a little wedge. And if it breaks away, that little wedge can actually wedge into different parts of the knee and it can lock the knee in position, in which case it, you know, should definitely be removed. But if you have a ripped meniscus or a torn meniscus that's going to cause inflammation and wear down the hyaline cartilage, it should probably be removed anyway. And it used to be when people had a damaged meniscus, the surgery would just remove the whole meniscus from the knee, which then made the knee fairly unstable because this meniscus is there to make the femur match up nicely with the tibia right here. But it also did what? It also protect the hyaline cartilage on the end of the bone. So when it was completely removed, that resulted in severe arthritis later on in life of the knee joint. So now, of course, Physicians always use their best judgment to remove the offending piece, but leave as much of the meniscus as possible in the knee so that you have the proper motion and proper protection between the articulating surfaces. So that's really what you pay the big bucks of a surgeon to do. Not just to do surgery, but to what? Exercise that best judgment. What should be removed, what should be left in. Okay, so let's see, what have we talked about in here so far? Okay, weeping lubrication comes from the synovial membrane into the synovial cavity. That's where synovial fluid comes from. So that acts, that decreases inflammation. All right, there are several factors that influence stability of joints. And some of us that are a little bit more athletically inclined than others are familiar with these things. Of course, it depends on the shape of a joint, what kind of motions are allowed. Like, for instance, the joints of your fingers, your digits, okay, can just flex and extend. It acts like a hinge joint. You don't ever want to bend a finger laterally at a knuckle joint because the shape of those joints means that one of those bones are going to break. Right, so the shape of the articulating surfaces plays an important role. All right, but that's not anything that you can really remodel over your lifetime. All right, if there's damage to a joint, for instance, there's really nothing you can do to help improve the function of a joint by changing its particular shape or surface. And then there are ligaments. So here is a bone-to-bone connection. This is the fibular collateral ligament, and it's a bone-to-bone connection. And it does not have a blood supply, so when it gets damaged, it has a tendency not to heal itself. It can't get any shorter, can't really get any longer. All right, so once it's damaged, then it no longer provides a lot of stability for the knee. So again, that's kind of like what? The shape of these articulating surfaces. What you have, okay, by adulthood is what you're going to be living with for the rest of your life. So how can you rehabilitate a knee joint or any particular joint in your body? Here is the third thing. It's the third item on this list, but it's probably the most important. And that is muscle tone, muscles that work across a joint. So how does a muscle attach to a bone? What's the name of that particular kind of tissue? It's called a tendon, right? And tendons are a lot like ligaments, right? Once a tendon is damaged, if it's stretched out, it cannot repair itself. So it can't get shorter again to provide tension across a joint. But since a tendon is attached to a muscle, one way to compensate for an overstretched tendon is to work that muscle, to make the muscle shorter. And you can do that with exercise. And then you can take up a lot of slack in that particular tendon and regain a lot of stability within a particular joint. All right, so for instance, when people have damage to a knee joint, here is the patellar ligament. And that attaches to the patella, and then on the superior margin of the patella, you have a tendon which attaches to very strong muscles in your thigh. So one way to stabilize the knee joint right here, right, is to exercise the muscles that are in your anterior thigh and posterior thigh, namely the quadriceps muscles. Right? And so if the patellar ligament is stretched or the quadriceps tendon is stretched, by exercising the quadriceps, then that takes up the slack in these particular devices right here, which then stabilizes the knee joint. So exercise, proper exercise with a person that's properly trained in joint rehabilitation can go a long way in stabilizing a joint that is injured, even though you can't reshape the joints, you can't reshape the ligaments by yourself, okay, but you can still work on the muscles that go across that particular joint. All right, but ligaments can be shortened surgically, but there's always a trade-off with surgery. Okay, what's something that always happens with surgery? What are some bad things about surgery? Well, initially infection, right? But you also have always scar tissue, right? And scar tissue sometimes is very hard to deal with. So working on muscle tone is a really nice way of rehabilitating a joint. All right, so we talked about bursa and tendon sheaths already. All right, let's talk about some movements of joints. And so what kind of joint is a freely movable joint, once again? That's a diarthrosis, right? Diarthrosis. So when we talk about these motions right here, we're talking about diarthroses in particular. Okay. Gliding joints. When one bone glides over another. Let's see what kind of example I can find for you. Okay. Gliding joints. For instance, bones of the carpals glide over each other. All right, so you can wave your hand back and forth, and that's because these joints between the carpals can, to some degree, slide over each other. But there are ligaments between them that limit the amount of gliding. All right, so that's a gliding kind of motion. All right, the next kind of motion. Most of the motions that we're going to talk about are antagonistic motions. So if you move your body in one direction, you can move your body in the opposite direction by invoking other kinds of muscles. So flexion and extension, that's a very important kind of motion to know. And I'm going to demonstrate it using my arm and forearm. So here is my arm, and then over here is my forearm. And right now, what kind of angle does my forearm make with my arm? 180 degrees. It's just a straight line. Okay. If I decrease the angle between those bones, okay, we call that flexion. So flexion is decreasing the angle. But if we increase the angle, that's not flexion, that's what we call extension, right? So these are antagonistic motions. So you can flex and extend your fingers, decreasing the angle between the bones of your digits. That's flexion. Increasing would be extension. You can do the same thing with your vertebrae, okay? And if you decrease the angle between vertebral bodies, like moving your head, like in the yes motion, that's what we call flexion, okay? And then if you bring your head back up to upright position, that's what we call extension. What else can you do with your neck besides extension? Extension would be placing your head right above your vertebral column. Well, what else can you do? You can actually look up like that, okay? That's what we call hyperextension. And in some joints, hyperextension is allowed. But for instance, what about your elbow joint? You've got flexion, you got extension. Can you hyperextend your elbow? Not without breaking something, okay? Unless maybe you've got some kind of interesting joint right there. Okay, and so there are many joints that are like that. Your fingers you can't hyperextend. Your knees you can't hyperextend. But if they do hyperextend, then that will cause injury to the joint. All right, so that's flexion and extension. Another antagonistic motion pair is abduction and adduction. You can do these with your, so here is flexion and extension, okay, of the vertebral column, maybe like in the lumbar region right here. I tell you what, since we're on flexion and extension, let's look at these right here. What about flexion and extension at the knee? All right, so when you're standing erect in anatomic position, if you bend at the knee and bring your heels up off the ground, you're decreasing the angle between your leg and your thigh, so that is flexion. All right, so you're bending around this point right here. And then extension is bringing back down into anatomic position. All right, let's look at the hip, for instance. So the hip with my torso right now is just what? 180 degrees, right? And if I bring my thigh up, what happens to the angle between my thigh and my torso? Does it decrease or increase? It decreases, so this is flexion. What do we call this? That's extension. And at the hip, you can hyperextend too. That's not such a big deal. All right, so it's easy to see flexion and extension at the hip. Where it's difficult to appreciate flexion extension is the shoulder. Okay, so flexion is when you move your arm anterior, when you raise your arm anteriorly, that is flexion, and extension is bringing it back down toward your side. Now you might be trying to look at, well, where is this angle that's increasing and decreasing? And here I think that model of thinking fails us all. There's really no way to appreciate that. You just kind of have to memorize. But I'll show you another way that I think about it. So flexion, extension, and then what do we call this when you put your arm behind you? Hyperextension. So you can hyperextend the shoulder without any problem. So in order to know that this is flexion, just think of match the motion of the shoulder with the hip. So when you raise the hip, what's that? Obviously, that's flexion. It's decreasing the angle. Same thing with the arm. And when you bring your thigh back down, that's extension. When you bring your arm down, that's extension as well. Okay? So just think of the motion at the hip to understand the motion at the shoulder as to whether it's going to be flexion or extension. Okay, so that's going to be really important to work these different motions out in your mind, because when we get to muscles next week, then we're going to be using these terms to describe the actions of various muscles. So you got to really have these on the tip of your tongue. Okay, so let's move to abduction and adduction. These have to do with your digits as well as your appendages. So in anatomic position, your hands are down by your side, your arms are by your side. If you elevate your arms like this, bring them away from your body, just straight laterally, not in a flexion mode, but straight laterally like that, that's what we call abduction. When you bring your arms back down to your sides, that is adduction. So that's pretty easy, just adding your arms to your body again, that's adduction. You can do that with your fingers and toes, for instance. When you give the live long and prosper sign like Spock did in Star Trek, what is that called when you spread your fingers out? I don't even know if I can do that, sort of like that. That is what? That is abduction. When you bring your fingers together, that is adduction. All right, so certain joints in your hand can do that, like between the proximal phalanx and the metacarpal right here. That's kind of a complicated joint that allows for flexion. All right, as well as abduction and adduction. That's allowed, that's nice at that particular joint. All right, circumduction is a motion that can take place. Well, adduction and abduction also can happen at the hip. All right, but the hip and the shoulder are interesting joints. They're what we call ball and socket joints. They have a lot of different degrees of freedom associated with them. And the shoulder and the hip can undergo circumduction. And circumduction is a compound motion that's made up of flexion and extension, abduction and adduction all at the same time. So circumduction is like making a windmill motion. And you can't do that with many joints, like your elbow joint you can't do that with, right? But only ball and socket joints can undergo circumduction. All right, so why are there these antagonistic motions in our body, like flexion and extension, abduction and adduction? Okay, so it's precise control and balance, right? And that's probably the most important thing that you can learn in an anatomy or physiology class. So we have some other antagonistic motions in your body. Supination and pronation in the forearm. In anatomic position, which way are your palms facing? Okay, when I'm relaxed, my hands are kind of like that, but that's not anatomic position, right? Your thumbs have to be which way? Okay, they've got to be lateral, that's right. They have to be facing laterally, which means your palms are facing anteriorly. All right, but you can make them face posteriorly if you want. Going from anterior to posterior, that's what we call pronation. So now my hands are pronated when you do that. And then when you bring them back facing anterior, that's what we call supination. It's a pretty easy way to remember that, because if you bring your palms together like that in a supinated position, what does it form? A soup bowl. Okay, so it's really easy to remember that. Dorsiflexion and plantar flexion has to do with the foot. And you probably recognize that your upper appendage and lower appendage really work a lot differently from each other. Like for instance, what at the elbow, what do we call this motion right here? Less flexion at the elbow, extension at the elbow, or you could say flexion of the forearm, extension of the forearm, either way, you know, it's fine. Okay. But now if I was going to flex at the knee, where would my leg go? Would my leg move anteriorly? My leg is going to move posteriorly like that. So the upper appendage is kind of twisted around compared to the lower appendage. So at the wrist, clearly we have flexion and extension at the wrist. But at the ankle, because things are twisted around, there's no easy way to think of flexion and extension. You can point your foot into the ground, that's a flexion motion, and you can lift your foot up off the ground, that's also a flexion kind of motion, because of the way things are twisted around. But because they're different, they have to have different terminology. So when you lift your toes up off the ground at the ankle like that, that's what we call dorsiflexion. And when you point your toes into the ground at the ankle, that's what we call plantar flexion. They're antagonistic motions for sure, but one is dorsiflexion and the other is plantar flexion. And just like in the arm, right, if the biceps right here is going to cause flexion of the forearm, the triceps causes extension of the forearm. You're going to find that used everywhere in your body. So for instance, flexion at the knee is with muscles in your posterior thigh. Extension at the knee is with muscles of your anterior thigh. Dorsiflexion is caused by muscles of your anterior leg. And then plantar flexion is caused by muscles in the posterior leg. Right? So opposite compartments will provide motion in opposite directions or antagonistic directions in your body. All right, what are some other kinds of motions? You might have some decent pictures in your book. Rotation. Where do I have rotation? Up over here. Rotation is around some kind of long axis, typically seen maybe with long bones, right? So with your shoulder, what can you do with your shoulder? Here is a really hard one to appreciate, all right? But what did we call this one? That's flexion, because do the same thing with your hip. That's flexion and then extension. So at your shoulder, you can flex, extend, hyperextend. You can abduct and adduct, okay, circumduction. There's something else you can do at the shoulder joint. So if I flex at the elbow right here, and then if I move my hand laterally like that, that is actually rotating the humerus with inside the shoulder joint. So this is a rotation of the humerus. All right, so the shoulder joint is pretty interesting and complicated because what can you do? Flexion, extension, abduction, adduction, circumduction, and rotation as well. All right, so so this is a lateral rotation. Here's a medial rotation. When we get to muscles, we'll talk about some muscles that make up the rotator cuff. We're going to be talking about rotation of the shoulder right here. All right, where else can you do rotation? You can rotate your head. Okay, back and forth like that. What joint allows for that kind of motion without breaking any vertebrae? Between C1 and C2, between atlas and axis. Okay, flexion is allowed between in your cervical spine between where and where? Between the occipital bone and C1. Okay, so flexion and extension. Okay, protraction and retraction. For instance, of the mandible. And be careful when you do this, don't chip a tooth, but you can jut your mandible forward like that. That's protraction, right? You can drop back inside underneath your head. That is retraction. And that's because the temporomandibular joint is really a complicated joint. It has a meniscus in it just like your knee does. All right, the other thing you can do with your mandible, right, you can elevate it like when you're chewing on something, or you can depress it, right? So elevation, depression with the mandible. And another kind of motion, inversion, eversion of the foot, going back down to the ankle. All right, with your ankle, you can like bend it laterally, you can bend it medially a little bit like that. Typically, that's how people sprain their ankles, unfortunately. And when you step, for instance, like on your lateral malleolus, what bone has a lateral malleolus? Write that down in your notes. What bone has a lateral malleolus? Which is another way of asking, which bone is the lateral one in your leg? And that is the fibula. The medial malleolus is on the tibia. So you got to get that down by next week, because next week the practicum is starting, right? So that's a really good thing to know. So when you stand on the lateral malleolus, like your fibula like that, bending your ankle, that's what we call inversion. And when you accidentally like stand on the medial malleolus on the tibia, that's what we call eversion. That's difficult to do. All right, so it's easy to invert your ankle, stretch out ligaments in your ankle when that happens. It's much more difficult to evert. But if you ever do by accident evert the ankle, then you know that's a much more serious kind of injury because there are more ligaments that protect from doing that kind of motion. And then opposition. What the heck is opposition? Because you have a fancy joint at your thumb, right? Not only can your thumb abduct and adduct, okay, flex and extend, okay, but it can go around anterior to your hand, right? And so that's what we call opposition, when you pinch your thumb to your fingers together. So you're going to see that that's a special kind of joint. But in terms of a functional classification, what is that thumb joint? And remember, what are the three, what's the word that's spelled by functional classification? SAD, got synarthroses, amphiarthroses, diarthroses. Which kind is this, is the thumb? It's the diarthroses, the freely movable. It's the very last one, right? All right, so one thing that determines what kind of motions are allowed at joints are the shape of the joints themselves, the articulating surfaces. All right, so here is a list of three different shapes of surfaces. Let's see what I can find. In your book right here. Oh, here's a pretty good example of dorsiflexion, lifting up off the ground, plantar flexion, pointing your toes into the ground right around this axis of rotation right here, antagonistic motions. And as an example, how important an understanding of all of these different motions are. For instance, years ago, before medicine was really complicated, you went to see a doctor. The doctor would be sitting at his desk or in his office, and the patient would walk into the room. And as the patient walks into the room, the physician, in many cases, would make a diagnosis just by watching the patient move, okay? And maybe looking at parts of their clothing and things like that. And still, physicians today like to look at the tips of people's shoes right here, okay? And if they notice that the tips of their shoes are worn down, okay, that's a nice indication of some spinal cord injury because it's not allowing a person to lift their toes up the ground, off the ground when they're walking. And why might that be really important? Maybe not so important in our age group, but think of your grandma and grandpa. If you lose the ability to lift your toes up off the ground when you're walking, then it's really easy to trip on something. And when you're up in that age, then it's really difficult to catch your balance before you fall. And if you fall and you're in your 80s, what's a likely scenario? What's likely to happen? Broken hip, right, or femur. Which then means then you can't stay at home. You have to go into a nursing facility. You're away from your family. You're away from your familiar surroundings. And a lot of people just kind of give up the will to live when that happens, right? So that can be a life-threatening kind of injury. So just picking up little signs of these inappropriate kinds of motions is really important. All right, and we'll see why that could be an indication of a spinal cord injury later on in the class. All right, so in terms of different kinds of joints by their shape, okay, like gliding joints right here, sometimes we call this a plane joint, so bones can just kind of slide over each other. This is not a rotational motion, so it's non-axial. There's no axis of rotation. It's just a gliding motion. And this is a good example would be between the carpals. Okay, a hinge joint. So here's a pretty good example of a hinge joint. It's just a uniaxial movement. That means that a rotation can take place, like for instance, flexion and extension, but no other kind of motion. And a good example of that would be between the ulna and the humerus, right? Between this articular surface on the humerus and this articulating surface on the ulna. So here's a good test question. What do we call this articulating surface on the humerus right here? Okay, and if it doesn't, it's not on the tip of your tongue, write it down in your notes. Make sure you go back and study that one a lot. So here is what, the trochlea, which is medial, and then laterally is the capitulum, and the trochlea articulates with the trochlear notch of the ulna right here. All right, and so in lab, you can see that this is a nice perfect kind of hinge joint just for flexion and extension. Of course, you can pronate and supinate at the elbow, but that's because of the joint between the radius, right, and the capitulum right here. That's a different kind of joint. That's almost like a ball and socket joint. All right, so a hinge is uniaxial. Good examples would be an interphalangeal, which is what? In between the phalanges of your digits. Those are just hinge joints. Your elbow and your ankle are hinge joints. All right, another kind of joint, a pivot joint between it's the proximal radial ulnar joint. So here's the head of the radius articulating with this little depression in the ulna. Ooh, who can remember the name of this little depression in the ulna right here? It's not named after the bone it's on, but the bone that articulates there. So that's what, the radial notch, right, in the ulna. And so this allows for pronation and supination, which is just a straight rotation right here. So here's a pivot joint. And also a pivot joint between C1 and C2, between the dens on C1 and the vertebral arch. I mean, the dens on C2 and the vertebral arch on C1, and that's held together with a transverse ligament. All right, and the proximal radial ulnar joint, which is this one. All right, so that's a nice pivot joint. And then we have condyloid joints. So what are these bones right over here? What are these bones called? I tell you what, let's start with these bones down here. What are these right here? These make up your wrist. Yeah, these are all carpals, right, that make up your wrist. And then you have metacarpals that make up your hand, right? So I want you to picture where your hand is. And then distal to your hand, you have your digits, right? And the bones of the digits are the phalanges. So here is a metacarpal. Here is a phalanx. And notice the shape of this joint. It almost looks like a ball and socket, but not quite. So what can you do with this joint? Of course, you can flex and extend. But what else can you do? You can abduct and adduct. So this is what we call a biaxial mode of rotation, right? So that's why you have nice dexterity on your hands, because the shape of this joint is not strictly a hinge joint. It has two modes of rotation, from right to left, as well as anterior posterior, so biaxial. So that's a nice condyloid joint. Where do we find that? Between a metacarpal and a phalanx right here. Well, that's a nice joint. And here is that joint we've been talking about that allows for opposition. It's a saddle joint between a carpal and number one metacarpal right here. And it's a biaxial mode of rotation as well, right, just by its shape. And it looks more like a saddle rather than just a very shallow ball and socket joint. So it allows for what? It allows for flexion and extension, and abduction, adduction, as well as opposition. So it's a little bit more, so this is again a multi-axial rotation because of the shape of this joint. And then lastly, all right, we have a ball and socket joint, and this is a nice true ball and socket where the head of the humerus or the head of the femur inserts into respectively either the acetabulum or the glenoid cavity right here. And this is a nice diarthrosis, multi-axial joint that allows for what? Abduction, adduction, flexion, extension, rotation even, and circumduction. And those are probably some of the joints that are most easily damaged, right? Because of all the range of motion that's allowed. The hip joint is a lot stronger because the acetabulum is a lot deeper, but the glenoid cavity is relatively shallow. But there is something on the edges, the margins of the glenoid cavity, that make the glenoid cavity a little bit deeper, and it's some soft tissue, and that's called the glenoid labrum. And that can be damaged by people pretty easily because it's not as strong as bone. But it does help stabilize the joint. If it is damaged, then it has to be repaired or removed, and then that kind of destabilizes the shoulder joint if that happens. All right, so let me see if I can find a picture of the glenoid labrum.
Is it on this slide right here? Here it is right here. Right, so here is the glenoid fossa of the bone, and then here is some fibrocartilage that forms a ring around the lip of the glenoid cavity, and that's the glenoid labrum. I thought it was labeled in your book. Okay, that's injured quite commonly. And let's see, important synovial joints. The shoulder joint and knee, and I'm going to focus on the knee in this class. And even on the practicum, when we get to joints, which is right after practicum number 2, the knee will be on practicum number 3. It's not something that you got to study over the weekend. So let's take a look at the knee joint. What bones are involved at the knee? How many are there? I count 4 in my mind. Okay, so let's take a look at what some of these bones are. Okay, the knee, we got a couple, at least one exam figure, maybe 2. A lot of good examples right here. Okay, so here's the knee, at least the superficial parts of the knee. We can see some muscles right above the knee in the anterior thigh. These are what we call the quadriceps. There are 4 of them, and you can see 3 of these important muscles. The 4th one is underneath the rectus femoris, which is right here. And then we have a bone, namely the patella. That's bone number 1. Bone number 2 is the femur, which I can see over here. And then the other 2 bones are the fibula and tibia. All right, and what about this tibia right here? Is that medial or lateral? And if it's not popping right into your mind, write that down to make sure that on the practicum and on the test, you know it well enough so that it just pops into your mind that the tibia is medial and the fibula is lateral. All right, so here we see a muscle-to-bone connection. And a muscle-to-bone connection is called a tendon. And so here is the tendon of the quadriceps femoris muscle. It inserts into the patella, the superior margin of the patella. And then we have the patella and some more dense regular connective tissue, which is a bone-to-bone connection. What do we call a bone-to-bone connection? That is a ligament. And so we call this the patellar ligament. So please understand that there's a difference between the tendon on the patella and the ligament right here. All right, and then if the patellar ligament gets damaged by stretching, how is it that you can restabilize the knee joint again? By exercising the quadriceps right here, by putting more tension on the patellar ligament, even though it's stretched out. All right, so here we have another bone-to-bone connection, which is a ligament, and it's on the side, so we call this a collateral ligament. And would you call this a lateral collateral ligament or a medial collateral ligament? Lateral, because the fibula is lateral. And then on the other side, here's another collateral ligament. And is that going to be medial or lateral? It's going to be the medial. Right, so you could call this the medial collateral ligament or the tibial collateral ligament. It doesn't matter. It goes by the same name. But you should at least know when people are talking about it. These other ligaments that I haven't mentioned, okay, like there are some retinaculums in here, like this medial retinaculum. A retinaculum is a broad, flat tendon, and it's not very strong. Right, so that's not something that I want you to know. But I do want you to know the tendon of the quadriceps, patellar ligament, the collateral ligaments, and then a couple more as we move inside the knee. All right, so here's another really good exam figure. And we can see the articulating surfaces on the femur. All right, so these are what we call condyles. What kind of condyle is this one here? That's the medial condyle. Here's the lateral condyle on the femur. You can see the intercondylar notch right here. And then on the tibia, these are condylar surfaces underneath the meniscus. So here's the medial condyle. Here's the lateral condyle on the tibia. And here's one meniscus. Here's the other one. So here's a lateral meniscus and the medial meniscus, which is fibrocartilage. And then here is the lateral collateral ligament going from the femur, epicondyle on the femur, down to the head of the fibula. And then here is the collateral ligament on the other side. So far, is it kind of making sense? It's not too complicated. It's not too bad once you see it. But don't forget about the patellar ligament, which goes between the patella and the, what's this part of the tibia called right here? That's the tibial tuberosity. That's easy to find. And then here's the tendon of the quadriceps. All right, so here you got the meniscus, medial meniscus, lateral meniscus. They're C-shaped. They're thin on the tips and then thin on the inside margin, thick on the outside over here. And then we have some other important ligaments that go from the intercondylar notch, which is on the posterior side of the femur, into the intercondylar eminence that we find on the tibia. It's some prominences that kind of poke up right here. They almost look like processes, but it's not for muscle attachment. It's for these ligaments. And these ligaments cross over each other. We'll see why they cross over each other in just a little bit. Right? And so these are what we call the cruciate ligaments because they cross over each other. The one in the front is the anterior cruciate ligament. The one that's in the back is the posterior cruciate ligament. So the knee is very easy to understand, and so you guys are going to get 100% on the lecture test and on the practicum when you get to it on P3. All right, so you got collateral ligaments, cruciate ligaments. You got the two menisci, got two bones in the leg. As long as you don't get medial, if you get medial and lateral mixed up on tibia and fibula, then yeah, all bets are off, and you won't get 100% because so much is involved in knowing what's medial and lateral in the knee. All right, then the patella ligament and quadriceps tendon right here. All right, so how can the knee be damaged? Why do we have all these ligaments right here? Right, aside from tearing these menisci, what's the motion that the knee can undergo? Think of the mandible. The mandible can protract, it can retract. What about the knee? Should it be able to do that? No, it doesn't protract or retract. What does the knee do? It's strictly a hinge joint, right? Flex and extend. So it's these cruciate ligaments right here that prevent protraction and retraction. So if somebody is hit in the leg from behind and it actually pushes their leg out in front of their thigh, right, then this anterior cruciate ligament gets damaged or it pulls off of this intercondylar eminence right here, right? So the anterior cruciate ligament prevents what? Protraction. And the posterior cruciate ligament prevents retraction. It's that if your leg gets hit from the front that pushes your leg behind your thigh, right, then it is the posterior cruciate ligament that becomes damaged. All right, what about these collateral ligaments right here? Again, think of what motion is allowed at the knee. It's what? Flexion and extension. Can you abduct or adduct any of your finger joints, interphalangeal joints of your finger? No, because that's going to damage something. The same with your knee. So this lateral collateral ligament is going to prevent adduction at the knee, and this medial collateral ligament over here is going to prevent what? Abduction at the knee. But if you have trauma to your leg and it bends the leg at the knee in those directions, then those are the ligaments that will be stretched or pulled off or damaged. So your book goes over that pretty well. I think you have some pictures. There's a picture right there. You can see the cruciate ligaments very nicely in this illustration, right, as well as the tendon of the quadriceps and the patellar ligament. What about, do we have a pathological case right here? Oh, lateral force. So here is an anterior, right? So here's anterior thigh, anterior leg. If there's lateral force, what prevents, and what is this motion called? It should be straight up and down, right? But it's not. The leg is bending outward because there's the lateral side. It's bending out. What motion is occurring, unfortunately, at the knee right here? That is abduction, right? And what ligament prevents abduction typically? That's the medial collateral ligament or the tibial collateral ligament. And if that force is sufficient, right, to actually cause abduction, then that's going to break that tibial collateral ligament, right? And it might also affect the anterior cruciate ligament, but for sure this collateral is. If it's forced medially, then it's going to be what? The lateral collateral ligament or the fibular collateral ligament that's going to be destroyed. So knee injuries are very common, so that's a really good joint to become familiar with. So if you need to draw that out to know where all these ligaments are, that would be fine with me. All right, so this will be on the next lecture test. The knee will be on the next lecture test, but the knee will not be on the next practicum. All right, joints will be on the third practicum. All right, so any questions on what is on the practicum coming up? anything in unit number two, which is bones, plus don't forget the skin model as well. So skin model. And you have some nice webcasts in Blackboard for the skin. Okay, so see you guys Monday. Some of you, 7:30, bright and early.